Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing in the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being. We're hoping, against hope, that we'll have our special guest here this evening. His name is Professor Ball. He's a professor up in Canada, here on the West Coast. He and a group of Canadian scientists are trying to get the truth out that we are being lied to about this global warming scam. Now, you have to understand what global warming is really all about. If you can convince the American people that there really is global warming, that it's going to melt the ice caps, that we're all going to die because of it, that the Empire State Building is going to be inundated and only the tip of it will be showing above the water, that the Statue of Liberty will be submerged, that our coastal cities will be submerged, that the climate will change so dramatically it will destroy the stability of our society. If you can convince people of this, why then, of course, you can justify destroying the infrastructure of our nation, which is really what this is all about. The Kyoto Protocol requires that the United States cut back greenhouse emissions to where they were back about 1990, which would mean we would have to simply abandon our industrialized society. This is a means of impoverishing the American people. This is what it's really all about. Now, how in the world have they been able to sell this to the American people? Well, you have to understand that the establishment, I call them the occult hierarchy, the spiritual hierarchy, call it what you will, controls the media. The media in the United States is controlled by five mega corporations, and that, of course, is Disney, Bertelsmann, Time Warner, the Murdoch, and Vioxx. Five mega corporations control the media in the United States. And, of course, working with the great tax-exempt foundations and many of our corporations and people of great wealth whose loyalty is not to the United States but this internationalist dream, they want to destroy the economy of our country. And this is the most incredible thing. And we're looking here and trying to see where the guest is. He's not... No, he's not. There's no lines. Our guest is supposedly online, but, hopefully we're getting him right now. Anyway, what they have done is they've sold the American people a lie. Now, they're able to control basically what the American people think. This is the great tragedy that we face today. And it really doesn't matter how ridiculous something is. If you control the media and you say it often enough and you teach it in our schools, and government scientists will lie because they want to keep their jobs, and university scientists in the United States will lie because they want to continue government grants, my friend, Dr. Art Robinson, sent a questionnaire out to about 20,000 scientists. And here in the United States, 17,000 scientists who are well aware of the issues as far as environment are concerned and atmospheric science are concerned, signed the petition saying there is absolutely no evidence that human activity has created global warming. But that really doesn't matter. The government got about 200 scientists to sign to say there was a problem. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Professor Ball. Professor, thank you so very much for being with us this evening.
Well, thank you for having me, Dr. Stan.
I mean, I think it's so vitally important that we get the truth out on this issue, and I congratulate you for your willingness and the organization, the little group that you're with, of academics up in Canada trying to get the information out. I've seen the wonderful video that you've put together going into the background of this whole scam. But, you know, it's the most incredible thing to me that they've been able to convince the entire American public of this lie.
Yes, and it's not just the American public. I mean, it's worldwide. And, you know, particularly people like Maurice Strong at the United Nations and the Rio Conference. And of course, the problem is that if you dare to question it, you lose the moral high ground right away, and that you're accused of being paid by the oil companies and so on. And that's part of the difficulty. And we're in what I call the age of environmental hysteria. There are pollution problems. There are things we need to deal with. But certainly global warming isn't one of them. And an illustration of that, Dr. Stan, is that Kyoto, here in Canada especially, is being pushed and at the United Nations level as a solution to pollution, but it's not. CO2 is not a pollutant.
All right. Could you explain to our listeners what this is really all about, what the scam is about the hockey stick idea and all of these things? I'm just going to let you pick up the ball and run with it.
Sure. Well, I guess thank you for Professor Ball to pick up the ball. That's a good one. Just to start out with, when I got a PhD in climatology, one of the first in the world, the consensus was we were heading for global cooling. So I've lived through two climate cycles now, the cooling one and the warming cycle, and we're now currently into the argument that warming is going to be the end of the world, and so that's where we are now. The fact is that the climate fluctuates a great deal all the time, and I think before I get into some of the science of it, one of the problems we've got is that we're educated to believe that change is very gradual over long periods of time. And that's part of the underpinning of the Darwinian view of the world. And of course, the minute you start looking at any period of time, scientifically, you find out that change and dramatic change is going on all of the time. And not just in nature, but also in human history. And like to point out to people, 2003 was the 70th anniversary of Hitler coming to power in Germany, and look at what's happened since then. And the same thing is true. My own research was based
on
the...
Hold that thought for just a moment. We want to bring our stations back on.
Sure.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Professor Ball, and he is a climatologist. He got a PhD in climatology a number of years ago, at which time everybody assumed we were moving into a period of global cooling. People have forgotten that Paul Ehrlichs of the world were writing books about the danger of global cooling back in the 1960s and 1970s. And, of course, they really couldn't utilize that to destroy the economy of the United States. So they come up with this scam about global warming. Now, could you, for our listeners out there, could you tell our listeners just a little bit about your position, where do you teach, and where you got your degree in climatology?
Yeah, I got my degree in climatology from Queen Mary College at the University of London in England, and I taught it in the University of Winnipeg and adjunct at Manitoba for 28 years. I'm not retired, I'm just doing something different, writing and publicly speaking about the climate change. Basically, the argument is that because humans are putting CO2 into the atmosphere, that CO2 is what they call a greenhouse gas. That is, it's one of three basic gases that allow the energy from the sun to come in, heat the surface of the Earth, and then that heat is slowed down or trapped in its escape. And the theory was that as the CO2 increased, then the global temperature would increase, and that became known as global warming. The actual effect of trapping the heat is the greenhouse effect. And but with the greenhouse effect, you can also have cooling. And this is one of the confusions in people's minds about what's happening. So the theory was that human production of CO2 through industry would increase the greenhouse gases and the CO2 particularly, and therefore the world would warm up. Just to illustrate how big this scam is, Dr. Stan, is that the CO2 is just a little over 3% of the total greenhouse gases. The most important greenhouse gas, which accounts for 95% of the greenhouse gases by volume, is water vapor. And they don't even talk about that. They just assume it's constant and essentially ignore it. And one of the reasons for that is the other part of the scam is that all of the predictions about what's going to happen are based on computer models. And the computer models are not able to incorporate the effect of clouds. So that's one of the reasons that they tend to overlook the water vapor issue. And so here we've got a model that ignores clouds and yet claims that it can predict what's going to happen with the global climate. I mean, it's just ludicrous. And I've got no problem with the models. If they want to play around with them in the universities, that's fine, and there's a scientific responsibility. But the minute that you go public and say, my model works and its predictions are accurate and public policy is based on that, then there's a whole social and economic responsibility that kicks in that's just being run roughshod over.
Well, my concern is that the Kyoto Protocol does not really influence China, which is the largest polluter in the world today. We're not going to have any restrictions on China or most third world countries.
No.
In fact, the only countries are really going to be impacted are the United States and I assume Canada as well, because of course our futures are so closely interrelated.
Yeah.
This looks to me like really an attack on the industrial infrastructure of the United States. Is that a fair statement?
I think that's a fair statement. Certainly when you look at the quotes from Maurice Strong, who was the one that was the organizer of the Rio conference, which is where Kyoto was born, I mean, he said that it's our duty to get rid of the capitalist countries of the world, or the industrialized capitalist countries of the world, And this guy has the ear of Kofi Annan and so on. But Kyoto was set out to do two things. One it was an attempt to take capital from the capital-rich industrialized countries that it was seen and pass it on to the poorer countries. So you've got this ridiculous situation where Canada is going to end up paying Russia $2 billion as part of our Kyoto commitment. And it just makes no sense at all.
Well,
your comment about India and China not being included, of course, is they are actually part of Kyoto, but they don't have to achieve any targets. But the other thing, Dr. Stan, is that Kyoto was about establishing by the Europeans a level trade playing field. Now, Americans know more about trade war between U.S. and Europe. Canadians have less knowledge of it, although the Canadian farmer does, because they become a victim of the subsidies that are going on. And but the Europe then used global warming as a nice emotional issue to say, well, we need to put a carbon tax on and level the trade playing field. For Europe to achieve their targets is quite simple. France is 80% nuclear. Britain is about 40% nuclear. And the coal they burn comes from Poland, and I understand it doesn't count. Germany had planned to close down inefficient coal-burning plants in East Germany, which achieves their target. And so when you start to look at the effect on Europe, they very cleverly set it up so it had no impact, or very little impact on them. But what's amusing about it is they're not going to meet their targets. And in fact, most of the European countries are going nuclear. And then that includes Blair. What Blair is doing is saying, oh, we can't have greenhouse gases because of global warming. And, oh, by the way, I don't like it, but we're going to have to go nuclear. It's our only choice.
And I really think that, well, in my estimation, this whole scam on nuclear is something that's been going on for 40 years as the nuclear industry has gone from weak hands to strong hands. And now, almost 40 years later, why they're going to go nuclear? Because it's the only thing that you can do. Otherwise, you will totally destroy the infrastructure of our society, which is, of course, what I think is going to happen anyway. And I would simply point out that Maurice Strong, for our listeners who do not know who he is, he's a multi-billionaire. He is the man who, until very recently, ran the United Nations. Kofi Annan was the front, but Maurice Strong ran that. Maurice Strong was a member of the Club of Rome, which back in 1972 published a book called The Limits of Growth, which said we're running out of everything. We're running out of air. We're running out of water. We're running out of food. We're running out of natural industries. We've just got to have sustainable development. And the first meeting was held in 1972, and then the second meeting was held in 1992 in Rio. And of course, this is where they actually laid out the this whole idea of the Kyoto Protocol. And going along with that, they introduced something called the Earth Charter, and it was written by Maurice Strong, Stephen Rockefeller, and, of course, a gentleman named Mikhail Gorbachev. And both Maurice Strong and Mikhail Gorbachev have referred to the Earth Charter as the new Ten Commandments for the world. And part of that, point number 10, is to redistribute the wealth not only within nations, but between nations. In other words, what they're really talking about is redistributing the wealth of the United States and Canada to other countries throughout the world. And most people would think that would be sort of crazy, but then sometimes I think we live in a world gone crazy. Do you ever have that thought, Professor Bob?
I certainly think so. And, you know, and just to flip back to the climate issue again, they virtually ignore the sun. And again, to illustrate the point about change, most of the textbooks in the United States and Canada, and many that I've looked at in England, tell the young people that the Earth's orbit is a fixed elliptical orbit. It isn't. The orbit of the Earth is changing every single year, and it goes from almost circular, as it is now, to extreme ellipse, as it was 22,000 years ago. And that's caused by the gravitational pull of the planet Jupiter. But it's not taught, and even though we've known about this for 150 years, I think that it's not taught because it challenges that view of change and dramatic change going on all the time. And the other thing is that the tilt of the Earth, now I know everybody knows the Earth wobbles, but the tilt of the Earth also changes from a minimum of 21.8 to a maximum of 24.4. So every single year, the orbit's different, which means the climate's going to be different, and the tilt is different, so the climate's going to be different. Yet none of that is included in their climate models. And the other thing that people have to understand about is how quickly and dramatically climate changes. If you consider that just 22,000 years ago, which most people can get their minds around that length of time, just 22,000 years ago, all of Canada, most of Alaska, and portions of the U.S. were covered with an ice sheet that was larger than the current Antarctic ice sheet. And there, we really don't know what caused that ice sheet to melt as quickly as it did. And it effectively melted in about 5,000 years. And by the way, there was another ice sheet covering Europe, a couple more in Siberia, so that 22,000 years ago, sea level was, Canadian terms, 150 meters, but about 500 feet lower than they are today. And yet here they're saying, oh, the sea level is going to rise, it's going to be the end of the world, and the sea level's risen almost 500 feet in the last about 10,000 years. The world didn't come to an end.
Well, no, but what happened? Because we know the time of Leif Erikson must have been about 1,000 years ago. Why,
yep.
Greenland was green, and they were growing grapes up in northern England, so they must have had a period of global warming then.
Well, that was a period. Now, there's two things going on. One is the changes in orbit and tilt, which we call physical sun-Earth changes. Those cause climate change, or they cause certainly changes in the energy coming from the sun and reaching the Earth. But then there's also changes in the output of energy of the sun itself. And so you get shorter cycles of climate change based upon those changes in the solar energy. The one you're referring to is called the medieval warm period, which was about 1,000 years ago. And yeah, the Vikings were farming in soil in Greenland that's now permafrost or permanently frozen, and they were sailing in Arctic waters that are now permanent pack ice. And then, of course, it cooled down, and you don't understand the fur trade in North America until you understand how cold it was in the 17th century and the demand for furs, because that's what drives economies. People don't do things arbitrarily. So the demand for furs increased, and the fur trade occurred. 1683, for example, they had 3 feet of ice on the Thames River in London, England. Yeah. Now, one of the things you mentioned in the promo, Dr. Stan, was the hockey stick.
Now, we're going to have to just take a quick break here.
Yeah, okay,
back,
sure.
I would like you to explain for our listeners the hockey stick, and then we probably would like to tell them how they perhaps can get hold of that wonderful video you put out. I think that's very, very well done.
Thank you.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here. Yeah. Our guest is Professor Ball, and you go right ahead.
Okay. Well, the hockey stick, I just talked about the warm period in around 1100. And by the way, this is another issue that when the world is warmer, generally, it's better for the human condition. I mean, the fact that they were able to grow surplus food and therefore if people had surplus time, they could spend a lot of time building Gothic cathedrals through Europe. It was a golden time. And then, of course, they got colder and the little ice age, as it's called, around 1600-1700s. Now, that was in the 1995 IPCC report, and this is one that the listeners need to be familiar with. It's the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Again, it's a product of the United Nations and Maurice Strong and all those boys. And the IPCC have been dictating to the world. It's used as the gospel. But there's so much wrong in it, particularly with the executive summary, which in many instances doesn't agree with the scientific part of the report. But anyway, in the 1995 report, they showed, oh yeah, there was the warm period when the Vikings were around, and there was a cold period of the fur trade. And then suddenly, in the year 2000, the report came out, and that was all thrown out. Thousands of pieces of research proving these events, and suddenly it was gone. Because a graph had been produced by Michael Mann and Bradley and Hughes, which is now referred to as the MBH 98 graph, and it showed almost no temperature change up until the 20th century and then a sudden sharp upturn.
And so really figures don't lie, but liars can figure, and they actually changed the chart and totally ignored that period of global heat, warmth that we'd had in the past and made it a flat line until we get right up to the very present, which makes it a hockey stick. Looks like this is something different throughout history, and it really isn't, is it?
No, that's right. If people want to look for that hockey stick graph and how it's used, National Geographic have it featured in their issue on global warming, and there's the hockey stick graph. And the hockey stick appears 5 times in the executive summary of the United Nations report. Why? Because Mr. Mann was one of the authors of that report. Now, what happened was, in science, you have to do what's called reproducible results. So other scientists must be able to reproduce the experiments that you do. So two Canadians by the name of McIntyre and McKittrick took the data and the formulas that Mann had used and ran the data and got completely different results and discovered that he'd left out most of the data to achieve the result that he wanted. And that hockey stick graph then became used and the public heard about it. Oh, this is the smoking gun. This is proof of humans causing the warming. It wasn't. All it was proof of was that somebody cooked the books. And they're still scrambling around trying to defend it. But, I mean, it's just completely indefensible. But it's had huge impact. And as I said, you see it in the National Geographic. And the Canadian government based their whole policy on that hockey stick graph. In fact, you can look at their website. And the Canadian government, you know, big money in our terms, but they spent $3.4 billion in the last 4 years, and virtually all of that on propaganda, ostensibly to deal with climate change.
And which is a non-issue. And yep. Certainly you and a group of scientists up there in Canada are trying to get that information out, aren't you?
Yeah. Well, what happened was that our minister of the environment at the time came out and said that the government had established their Kyoto policy and they had consulted the experts. Well, there were 8 Canadian experts.
Hold that thought right there for just a moment. It's our Jason Gray. Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest this evening. Is Professor Ball. He's a Canadian living up in British Columbia, I believe, at the present time. But he's taught at the university a level. He's got his courses, a PhD in climatology over in England. And of course, there is a group of scientists up in Canada who are not employed by the government, who are trying to get the truth out. And, of course, the government up there is intent upon going along with the government here. An attack on, in my estimation, on Western civilization using totally fraudulent science and graphs that are simply made up out of thin air to justify this. But, you know, it doesn't matter how ridiculous something is. If you say it often enough, people will believe. Now, Professor Ball was saying that the Canadian government has spent about $3.5 billion on propaganda, pushing this whole concept of Kyoto Protocol, because if they can sell it to the Canadian people and the people in the United States who are behind this can sell it to the American people, why, we can destroy the economies of both Canada and the United States. So you pick up the story there.
Yeah, well, as I said, the Canadian government bought into the whole thing. And by the way, in my opinion, one of the problems that we have, and I don't know if it happens in the U.S., but we had a senior bureaucrat, sort of an assistant deputy minister, who went into the government with the specific purpose of pushing his view on the policy, and he single-handedly was able to convince the politicians that global warming due to humans was a proven fact, and he drove the whole thing. And, of course, the difficulty with it is that most of the politicians don't understand the science. And so then, of course, they tend to lean towards, you know, oh, well, we're going to clean up the environment, and that's a good thing. So it's very easily sold. And so the Canadian government have signed the Kyoto Protocol. There are estimates. Ken Green at the Fraser Institute estimated it's going to cost our economy probably close to a third of $1 trillion over the next 10 years.
That's a lot of money for a small country.
Oh, it's huge. I mean, and just to put that in perspective, by the way, the population of Canada is the same as the population of California, but we're just slightly larger, you know,
right,
in size. and of course, trying to maintain the infrastructure of a country that large with the population that we have. But there's some other interesting things about this, Dr. Stan. For example, you know, when they were saying global cooling, the CIA spent several million dollars studying the impact of global cooling on world food production, and they created a word called climatocracy. And as I said, that was the big push then, the big lie then. Now, of course, we're into global warming. But my question is, you know, why are we being told that global warming is the end of the world? In fact, it is a good thing, because it opens up more areas for food production. And it means warmer winters, which means less energy being used. Now, it could mean slightly increased air conditioning costs in places like the U.S., but overall, you can't see it doing anything but good.
Well, of course, the one thing is, though, that if they could get us to stop producing electricity, why, we wouldn't be able to have air conditioning. This would be a ridiculous thing about this. They really want us, everything, the stress here in the United States is conservation, cut back on electricity use, cut back on the use of water, cut back on the use of your car, your automobile. That's what it's really all about, and all of these things go back to Marie Strong.
Yeah. One of the things, by the way, I mentioned about they're ignoring water vapor as a greenhouse gas. So they effectively ignore the sun as a cause of climate change, and yet people like Sally Baliunas at Harvard and several other American researchers and some Canadians have shown the connections between the sun. So you're ignoring the sun and you're ignoring the water vapor. And the analogy I use is like saying, my car's not running very well. I'm going to ignore the engine and the transmission and look at one nut on the right rear wheel. But there's another factor here. Because they ignore the water vapor, they're ignoring something that that we should be looking at, not to raise it hysterically as a concern, but what's going to happen with the precipitation. Now, you know, and American farmers know, that you get the drought years, and droughts are a problem. And so what we really need to know is what is the precipitation going to do? And, well, they say, oh, things like weather's going to be more drought. Well, my research here in Canada shows there's been far more severe droughts in the past. So that doesn't hold up in the historic record. But that's the real issue, because droughts lead to problems of food production and so on. And but that gets ignored because the focus is on warming. And by the way, Dr. Stan, like for America, especially the northern states and Canada, we're far better planning for warming, because if we warm, then we can expand north and we can introduce more agriculture. If it cools, we're better planning for cooling. Sorry, I got my ideas mixed up here. We're better planning for cooling, because if it warms, we simply expand northward. If it cools...
Hold that thought right there.
Yep.
Well, there's Dr. Stan. Go right ahead, Doctor. Go right ahead.
Thank you, Ed. Well, what I'm suggesting is that for most of the world, and certainly for Canada and the northern U.S., we're better to plan for cooling, because if it warms, we simply have longer frost-free seasons and can grow things further north. But if it cools, we're simply in a lot of trouble. I mean, there's nobody farming north of Canada. And yet the Canadian government, all of its research and planning is to prepare for warming. The evidence right now is, but again, it's not getting covered because the media are caught up in this warming thing, but there's been record colds around the world. I mean, last summer, the Canadian prairies had the coldest and wettest summer in 100 years. And I spoke to corn growers in the eastern prairies of Canada. They had no crop at all because they had a very hard frost, a killing frost, on the 20th of August. And the same is true. You look at Europe right now, how cold it is. Cold in Pakistan and Bangladesh, and people dying of exposure. Australia 2 years ago, most of Australia, or large parts of Australia, had the coldest summer in 100 years. But none of this is getting reported because the focus on the CO2 and the warming, not just of the government, but also of the mainstream media. And we certainly see that as a problem up here in Canada, that trying to get them to report on things that about the weather that they don't think fits their agenda.
Well, now, tell me, one of the things we hear so much about is how the ice cap, the Arctic ice cap, is melting. Is that really true, or is that simply a normal thing that we would see? Because we probably have had a degree of warming over the last 100 years or so?
Well, the degree of warming over the last 100 years was a figure produced by Phil Jones, and also Mr. Mann was involved in that again. And there's some researchers trying to get Mr. Jones to release his data and how he came up with that number. So there's questions about that. Certainly, since 1978, the surface stations show warming, but the satellite that covers the whole globe shows no warming at all, so even the 1 degree warming. But back to your question about the Arctic, and I flew search and rescue in the Arctic and also done a lot of research up there. First of all, the Arctic Ocean, about 14 million square kilometers, and it freezes over in the wintertime, but half of it melts in the summer. So seasonally, there's a 50% change in the Arctic ice. Latest report, the Arctic Climate Impact Assessment, came out and said, oh, there's been dramatic warming in the last 30 years. Well, yeah, the record does show some warming in the last 30 years.
Hold that thought for just a moment. We'll bring our stations right back on. Well, Dr. Stan and Professor Ball is talking about the Arctic. Now, you hear so much about, well, the Arctic ice cap is melting, and of course, he apparently has spent a fair amount of time up there, search and rescue, and he points out that the Arctic ice pack melts in the summer, and it freezes over in the winter. It melts in the summer, and it freezes over in the winter. And, of course, when you see those pictures on your television or in the New York Times or the Washington Post, that's in the summertime when the Arctic is melting. But what about the winter? Are we losing Arctic ice pack, or is this simply part of the scam?
No, it's part of the scam because, first of all, as I was saying, yes, it's warmed up in the last 30 years. A professor out of the University of Alaska shows that. But it also shows that there was a more dramatic warming prior to 1940. And there was no great concern then. And, in fact, it was warmer in the 1940s in the Arctic, especially Western Arctic, than at present. While the Western Arctic and Alaska is showing warming now, the Eastern Arctic has been showing much colder. And in fact, that's one of the reasons why there's been a decline in the cod fisheries on the East Coast. It was due to water temperature. Again, they try to blame the fishermen, said there's overfishing. It had nothing to do with it. The Canadian government haven't allowed fishing for 12 years. The cod numbers haven't recovered simply because it's water temperature. It's got nothing to do with the overfishing. But that's another of the scams that's going on. But back to the Arctic ice question again. There's always open areas of water in the Arctic, even in the wintertime. The wind shifts and the ice opens up with leads. And there are also areas what we call polynyas, which is where there's upwelling of warm water that keeps open areas. So the Arctic is never completely covered over, but it's about 98% covered in the winter time, and then it's 50% covered in the summer. There was an argument about the ice being thinner, but that was another just an outrageous piece of information, because the earliest measurement we have of Arctic ice was done by one American submarine going under and measured the thickness of the ice in the 1960s, which was a colder period. And then 30 years later, two more submarines went underneath, measured again, but they measured in a different month, and they used a different form of radar, sideways scanning radar, which gave different results. And then it came out and said, oh, well, the ice is thinner now than it was 30 years ago, and this is proof of warming. It had everything to do with how they did the measurements and when they did the measurements, and was no real indication of what was going on at all. But again, the media pick up on these things, and that's what goes on. I can, Dr. Stan, I can relate a report to you where they said over 60,000 square miles of Arctic ice had melted for the first time in centuries, and the Royal Navy was writing to the British government saying, you know, what are you going to do about this? And this was a report done in 1816. So, you know, you don't have to go far back in the record to see dramatic changes going on. And when you go through the Arctic, as you go back to that medieval warm period I mentioned earlier, the Vikings sailing in waters that are now permanent pack ice, you just pick your time and you pick your trend, and you can show virtually anything.
All right, now, of course, you and your group that you work with have actually put together an excellent video. It's not that long. What is it, about 30 minutes or so?
Yeah, 25 minutes.
And how can people actually get copies of that? Because you've really got the information there that I think will convince anybody who is certainly impartial that this is one of the greatest scams of modern times, this threat of global warming. So how can people get hold of that or get more information on this subject?
Well, the easiest way is to go to the website of a group that I helped set up. I'm actually a technical advisor to the group, and it's a group of retired geologists and hydrologists and so on who were so angry about the bad science that they decided to put a video together. And their website is friendsofscience.org. That's all one word, friendsofscience.org. And on that website, they can download the video. It's in five parts, so it don't swamp your machine. And that's the quickest and easiest way to get that video.
And it's an excellent video, and I recommend it to you. You know, it's got Dr. Baliunas, who we know personally and we've spoken to many times. And then, of course, this whole scam of the hockey stick, you've got to see how they've used this. And they've simply used fraudulent information. When you understand that a great deal is at stake here. The very survival of America and our industrial capacity as we know it, our industrial society, and it's under attack by people who have a different agenda. And this is being led by that great American patriot, Mikhail Gorbachev, who works with his close friend, Marie Strong, and, of course, their close friend together, Stephen Rockefeller, the son of Nelson Rockefeller. And you might wonder why this strange group of two billionaires would be working with the former head of the Soviet KGB, but, well, if you wanted to attack America, do you know any better way than to do it by this means? And where we would actually be transferring our wealth to other countries. And didn't you say that you'd be transferring in Canada a couple of billion dollars to who would you be sending your money
to? Well, to Russia, $2 billion to Russia as part of the transfer carbon credits. See, and that's another thing. The carbon credits, which is what Kyoto is based on, doesn't reduce the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere. It just simply is a transfer of wealth, so that Canada, if it wants to continue operating at its current level, has to pay these other countries to buy carbon credits. And so one of the things we're arranging to do is to pay Russia $2 billion to buy carbon credits from them.
And of course, it really doesn't make any sense, because it doesn't cut down on the CO2 emissions at all if you're getting credit. All it is a massive plan for wealth redistribution. And, of course, what they're really talking about, ladies and gentlemen, is it's your wealth. Because, of course, if the government's transferring money, if the corporations are transferring money, in the final analysis, it is the middle class that is being transferred from the middle class to impoverishment.
Now, Dr. Stan, just to illustrate how crazy this can get, in Canada here, the government, because they brought out their Kyoto plan, and by the way, we were quite proud of the fact that on the day that we held a press conference in Ottawa to release our video, the government moved up their agenda and announced their Kyoto plan to draw the media away from us, and they put out a plan that is so silly that even the Greens said it doesn't work, but they had to rush to get it out. That because they're failing to convince the public of that, the public don't fully understand, but they sense there's a scam going on here. The government of Canada are now moving to make CO2 a toxic substance. Now, we have something called the Canadian Environmental Protection Act, and if you list something under there as a toxic substance, then it gives the government a draconian action or abilities to move in. And, for example, if they list CO2, they could just simply go into an industry and say, you know, you're exceeding limits of CO2, and we're going to shut you down.
But, of course, life, human life, animal life, even plant life cannot exist without CO2. Plant life certainly cannot exist.
Well, that's right, and I always tell people, you know, the plants have no vote in this. I mean, if you're going to list CO2 as a toxic substance, you might as well list oxygen and all the other gases that are in the atmosphere. But of course, it's a measure to me of how driven they are to achieve their agenda and just run roughshod over the science, the evidence, and logic.
Well, of course, we're living in a world that's gone mad. There are only a few of us are still sane, and everybody thinks we're crazy. If you're out there in the listening audience and you have a question on this comment, we've only got a few minutes more, but we'd love to hear from you. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. That's 464-8295. And Professor Ball is retired, but he has his degree in climatology. And the climatology experts who are not employed by the government will tell you this is foolishness. The people who work for the government, if they want to keep their jobs, are going to falsify science. But then, after all, if your job, if your pension, if your health insurance, if your children's future depend upon your simply compromising on the truth, well, I regret to say it, but some scientists will do that because they have to have a job. And, you know, it is a tragic situation where people will use science and use threats and intimidation. I can tell you, I've talked to people, not on this subject, but on others, people working in universities who've been threatened to keep them quiet from bringing the truth out to the public. So we've got real problems, and I think that this group of scientists that you're working with have done a tremendous job of at least putting together a message. How well is it getting out across Canada? Do you really think that increasing numbers of people are beginning to realize that the media is not telling them the truth, and the government is not telling them the truth, and the IPCC report is really not true?
Yes. One of the comments I talked to, last year, 150 different groups, and probably several thousand people, and the comment I get after is, we had our suspicions, but we didn't know enough to know. And so gradually, people are becoming aware, and of course, part of the problem in Canada is people have a much greater trust of government than Americans do, and it's an unhealthy thing, so we've got that to overcome. But slowly but surely, the big lie is being overcome. But the problem is, of course, as I said, you've got to overcome people's emotions, because they say, well, you know, they're being beaten over the head with what I call the emotional threat. So, well, your children are going to die, and so on. That's very hard to counteract that. And then people say, well, you don't care about pollution. Well, we do. And as a matter of interest, in Canada, because the government spent $3.4 billion on propaganda on climate change, they didn't even achieve their targets for dealing with pollution in the Toronto area and southern Ontario, for example. And this is another part of the issue. And by the way, Dr. Stan, I realized that there couldn't have been a better start to the new millennium than Y2K, which was another scam, as you know. And they got us so upset about it, they got us celebrating the new millennium in the wrong year. I checked newspapers worldwide and media reports. I've yet to find a problem with a computer anywhere. And the Canadian government spent $5 billion on the Y2K thing, and in that same year, the people of Canada, through their provincial, which is equivalent to state representatives, went to the federal government and said, we need $5 billion for health care, and the government said, we don't have it. They spent it on this Y2K nonsense. And I think it was the perfect start to the 21st century that here was another speculative scare and scam planes are going to fall out of the sky and everything else. It typifies what's been happening. And it's always been that the tail wagged the dog, but what we got now is the flea on the hair on the tail that's wagging the dog.
Let's go to Jack, who's calling us from Michigan. Yeah. Hi, Jack. How are you doing?
Hi, Jack.
You speak up now.
Yes. Thank you for taking the call. It sounds like, theoretically, with the fact that plants utilize CO2 in the production of oxygen, it would seem a novel idea that the government could easily spend the money purchasing trees from whatever foundation or companies can provide the trees for everyone to plant in their communities.
Now, what you're suggesting is we'd take the CO2 out of the air by simply planting more trees.
Yeah, Dr. Stan, I'm thinking the more CO2, the better, because then, you know, more of it can be utilized to produce oxygen.
All right, fine. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, just very quickly, one of the things that I mentioned earlier was the theory is that if the CO2 goes up, the temperature goes up. In fact, the science shows, the ice core record, which is the one they all quote, that the temperature changes before the CO2, not the other way around. In other words, the basic theory is wrong. Jack is absolutely correct. The reason that the CO2 goes up when it goes up, the plants grow more effectively. In fact, there are studies here in Canada that show that about 2 bushels per acre increase in wheat yields was due to the increasing CO2. In greenhouses now, where they're growing tomatoes and things, they're pumping in CO2 with levels up to 800 and 1,000 parts per million, which is 3 times the atmospheric level, because the plants grow more vigorously. The idea of reforestation, of course, is one thing that that can be done if you want to reduce the CO2 levels. But that's another of the big lies. I mean, the amount of forest increase over the last 30 years, there's 15% more forest in Europe now than there was 30 years ago. And in fact, ironically, in Scotland, they've been complaining because the government were planting trees where they claimed there weren't trees before. So there's no pleasing some people. But reforestation is becoming very effective, but Jack is absolutely right. It would be a very good way of dealing with the issue.
Okay, anything else, Jack? Okay, fine. Well, thanks very much. But I think your point is well made. But of course, I really don't think that it's the that much of a problem. But they're going to keep hammering away at this. I think maybe we ought to come up with a solution. Yes, there's more CO2 in the environment. But so what? It's really good for the plants, good for the trees, good for society. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, we've got about 4 minutes or so before we're going to have to let you go this evening, but I do hope we can get you on some of our other programs. We have the unique opportunity of speaking to three fairly substantial audiences across America 5 days a week. And then we have to do another program on weekends as well, which gets to a fair number of stations. So at least we have a small voice. And, of course, there's more and more small voices. Certainly, I'm sure your group is reaching an awful lot of people. I think that's really great. And then there are other groups here. There's a group with us every Wednesday evening takes my program called Freedom 21 Santa Cruz. They're part of a Freedom 21 group across America. And they're reaching large numbers of people. So, you know, I think that the other side is really worried. But what bothers me is what they're doing to the minds of our children in school.
Yep.
They're really indoctrinating them in a lie.
Yes, and I've been involved in the schools throughout my career, and I got involved, for example, first with agriculture in the classroom because we discovered how badly agriculture was being taught and covered. And certainly through one of the problems we've got in the schools with global warming and climate change is that it tends to be in the social science side of the curriculum rather than in the science side of the curriculum. And of course the social science teachers here in Canada, and I can't speak to the ones in the U.S., but they tend to be certainly most of them more left-wing in their view of things, and so they present a very biased view. And I've just finished a teacher's guide to go with another video that I've done, and also with the video that you've mentioned that is being requested by more and more teachers. And so it's interesting. A lot of parents don't know what their children are being taught in the schools, and I think it behooves them to go and have a look and see what their children are learning.
I agree with you totally. And they're being really, I think, schooled in this whole idea of environmentalism, but with a strange spirituality behind that.
Yes.
Almost as if there is some sort of divine presence within nature, having nothing to do with the traditional God of the Bible. That myth, their faith in God is being undermined. They're certainly learning an awful lot more about sex than they are about Shakespeare, far more about Marilyn Monroe than about mathematics. Anyway, we'll be back in just a moment here to wrap up this evening's program. Well, Dr. Stan, we've got just 3 minutes here before we have to let you go. So what is the parting thought that you would like to leave with our listeners this evening?
Well, I think that the parting thought is to try and get to the other side. There are a couple of good websites in the United States that I can refer you to. One is jugscience.com. by Steve Malloy, and his coverage of the climate scam is superb. And and then the one I mentioned, the Friends of Science here in Canada. But I think that people need to understand that it's absolutely critical that we get all sides of an argument out there, and that they learn that there are people that only want to present you with one point of view, and when they use emotion, they can control the field much too easily, and that's what's going on. And I advise people develop a detector. Some of the things you see is the minute somebody says, "Oh, the children or the grandchildren are threatened," I start being extremely cautious about what's going on. So just simply keeping your eyes open, trying to say, "Well, what's the other side?" Ask the question, yes, but is it true? And you see in Africa, for example, now the African country is saying, we've got eco-imperialism. You won't let us use DDT, so we got 2 to 3 million of our people dying of malaria every year. And all the same environmental religion as you refer to.
Well, Chris, you know, we still see all these articles about how terribly dangerous DDT is. And, of course, I've talked to scientists who feel that this is really one of the most amazing insecticides we've ever had. What are your thoughts on that? And I know that's a little off the subject and perhaps not even in your field of expertise, but is it true that the ocean is still polluted from the use of DDT of 30 years ago?
No. And of course, one of the things that Malloy has is a book that lists books that were wrong. And of course, Rachel Carson's Silent Spring started all of this. And you can just look at the hysteria one after another. And the problem is that you end up throwing out the baby with the bathwater. And certainly DDT, and then we saw it with Roundup and other things that advance the food production. And by the way, the part of the proof of that, as you mentioned earlier about the Club of Rome, you go back and look, they said the world would be starving to death by the year 2000. We would have no food left. And now we've got the American government paying farmers not to grow.
We live in a world gone mad.
It's just ludicrous.
We're out of time. God bless you. Yeah. Thanks so very much. I hope we can get you on again.
Thank you, Dr. Stan.
Good night. Bye-bye.
Good night.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here, and let me just suggest that you need to get more information. We have a wonderful four-tape set on population control because, of course, the entire thrust of everything that's going on is this really evil intent to kill off large parts of the world's population. And, of course, to create all sorts of crises and epidemics and wars and violence and chaos because there are too many people in the world. That was the basic thrust of the Club of Rome report back in 1972, The Limits of Growth. And then it was that same year that the first Earth Summit was held. The second one was held in 20 years later in 1992, the third one in 1997, and the last one in the year 2000. At that point, everything was in place for the destruction of Western civilization. And, of course, they've written a new Ten Commandments. They call it the Earth Charter. They placed it in a new ark. As the old Ten Commandments was placed in the Ark of the Covenant, this is placed in the Ark of the Hope. And behind this whole scam are, in my opinion, dark Luciferian forces. We hope that you'll certainly want to get some of our material. We have a great four-tape set on sustainable development. We have a video on sustainable development, and it's called Sustainable Development, The Road to the New World Order. And then we have a great syllabus. There's nothing quite like it, but you'll see actually the pictures of the Georgia Guidestones, where the master plan is laid out to kill off 90% of the world's population. Material on Marie Strong, material on Barbara Marx Hubbard, who in her books talks about the necessity of killing a quarter of the world's population. And then the demonic spirit, because she admits, of course, her book was channeled to her, the demonic spirit which wrote her book says, "And that is not your job, my dear, that is ours, for we are the riders of the pale horse death." You'll actually see the quotations from the pages of her book. You need to get that information. You need to understand what's really going on behind the scenes. So the sustainable development four-tape set and or video and or syllabus, of course, the material on population control, the four-tape set, and the video, and of course, my population control agenda monograph, it's available on our website at radioliberty.com, or you can request it if you get any of the other items, and we'll send that to our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-544-8927. We have a great book. It's entitled Set Up and Sold Out by Holly Swanson. You'll read there the quotations from David Foreman, who organized Earth First, and he wants to get the world population down to about 100 million. That means killing off about 98% of the world's population. There really are people who are backed by very wealthy and powerful men who want to kill off the majority of the people in the world. And you pretty much understand their mentality, because these people look at the world differently than you and I do. They have a different worldview. And if you'd like to understand what they believe, you need to get my book, Brotherhood of Darkness. That's Brotherhood of Darkness. You can get the book, the video, the audio tape, get them all separately or all together as a Brotherhood of Darkness special. And, of course, you'll really understand what motivates everything going on in the world today. That's Brotherhood of Darkness, the book, the video, the audio tape. They all tell the same story, but if you get them all together, you can copy the video, you can copy the audio tape. And I had a girl, woman call me today and told me that she had actually had a man coming around, wanted to sell her some knives. He was going to join the Masons. She told him she'd buy a set of knives if he would simply read the one chapter in my book about the Masonic Lodge and what its real purposes are. And well, she said that it cost her $500 for the knives, but that she thought that he wasn't going to join the Masons. Anyway, the book has a great message in it, not because I wrote it, because I'm not a great writer, but because the information is there, and you need to get the information. Please go to our website at RadioLiberty.com. If you'd like a free copy of one of our newsletters, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927, and then pray for America. Pray for revival, but please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection, and for those who are leaving, why, we'll be with you again tomorrow. Otherwise, hang on, and we'll be back in just a moment here for the second hour. Stand back here with you once again, coming from the hills, overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views. The views of our guests, and of course, this evening, we invite your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. That's 464-8295. But please hold your calls. We have this on the line from World Affairs Brief, which is a website that will give you the daily update on the news, which you certainly want to be getting every morning. We have Andrew Skousen, and he's one of the researchers, gets the information up there on a daily basis, and we're pleased to have him with us tonight to bring us up to date on what's really going on in the world, the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hi, Andrew. How are you doing tonight?
Just fine, Dr. Stan. Pleasure to be with you.
Well, it's always great to have you with us. Well, tell us what these stories are we're going to be covering tonight.
Well, I think the biggest story I'd like to comment on today, I'd actually like to comment on it at length, has to do with the recent developments with the historical Watergate case. And I'd like to, I imagine you've already gone over it to a certain extent with our listeners because it's such a big story, but I'd like to touch on some of the aspects that our group has come up with as far as analysis of the story, if you don't mind.
No, not God. That's why I have you here, to give your opinion, and of course your and your dad's and your brother's opinion, because you always have a very interesting take on it. So everybody knows, of course, that Mark Felt had come forward and said that he was deep throat, and had been confirmed by Woodward and Bernstein, but there's probably a great deal more to the story than has really been told. So you pick up the story and run with it.
Very good, Dr. Stan. Yes, as you mentioned, the story really is about Mark Felt, and my father is probably one of the few people in our group who was actually involved. Well, how should I say, active in politics at the time that the Watergate scandal was developing. It was before my time and a little bit before my brother's time, I believe as well. And he said that it was very interesting to go back through and put all the pieces back or to put all the pieces together once he finally found out who Deep Throat was. And since then, of course, there's been quite a bit of commentary. We'll look into a little bit about John Dean's commentary, who was Nixon's White House counsel at the time, and he makes some very interesting remarks about this. And it's a lot of interesting aspects about the story of the Watergate trial, because there have been a great number of conspiracies and government issues that have come up that pale in comparison to Watergate, only because media made such a big deal about Watergate, it seems. And so seeing the why and the how of this makes this a very interesting case.
Well, we're going to be back here in just a minute or two, up again, talking about the how and the why, because there's far more to this story than the average person understands, and you're certainly not going to hear these things mentioned on the controlled media. Controlled by Bertelsmann, Disney, Murdoch, Viacom, and Time Warner, the five mega corporations that control our media, dominate our media, control what the American people hear, what they read, and what they see. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course, I'm talking about Watergate this evening. This fascinating article by Seymour Hirsch, which was up on WorldNet Daily today. Pardon me, up on, it was on the World Affairs Brief today, and I just wanted to briefly comment on this because Seymour Hirsch, writing in the latest issue of New Yorker, said that he was around, of course, when this story was unfolding, and he had information that Henry Kissinger, who was the, I believe, the Secretary of State at the time, was having his aides and many other people there in the White House, their telephones were tapped. So he went to, he had this information from the FBI, so he went to Henry Kissinger and said, Mr. Kissinger, or Secretary Kissinger, I understand that you have telephone taps on many people in the White House. Is that true? And Henry Kissinger, in his gruff, guttural voice, said, of course it's not true. What a terrible thing to say. And, of course, then Seymour Hirsch said to him, I have this from solid evidence from the FBI that you actually have been tapping all these people's telephones in violation of the law. Whereupon Henry Kissinger said, if this becomes public knowledge, I will have to resign. So then Seymour Hirsch begins to talk about all the pressure that is put on him. And people are calling him and saying, Seymour, ordinarily they would call him Cy, but now they're calling him Seymour, aren't you Jewish? I mean, do you honestly believe that Henry Kissinger, who is a good Jew, would be doing something that dishonest? And of course, they just demanded that Seymour Hirsch not bring this story out. And then, of course, it sort of got lost along the wayside. But it was fascinating to see Seymour Hirsch writing about this. Henry Kissinger was doing something far more dishonest than anything Richard Nixon was doing. And you will never hear these stories. And there's one reason I really enjoy reading Seymour Hirsch. He's a fellow who's been there. He's seen it all. And although he's very much in the left wing, some of his reporting is fascinating, and I've never caught him in a lie or anything I did not believe was absolutely true. So that was what was going on at that time, and I really believe one of the... Well, I have always felt that Henry Kissinger was really, of course, encouraging Nixon to go along with the plumbers. I was encouraging Nixon to go along with having this secret group and authorizing the break-in at Watergate. But you pick up the story there, Andrew, because I think the view that you have on what happened is very, very significant.
It's true, and it's very similar. It's interesting that you mentioned the Seymour article, because I was reading that recently as well to catch up on some of the history that I missed being young at the time, and I found his article to be very cogent as well. Although, like you said, it does have a certain left wing slant.
Hold on, we'll be right back here.
All right.
All right. Well, this is Andrew Scows, and he's going to pick up the story of this latest scandal having to do with Deep Throat. Mark Felt, and, of course, Woodward and Bernstein. So pick up the story there, Andrew.
All right. Well, I think one of the most difficult aspects to understand about the Nixon investigation and his subsequent resignation was why it was that the administration, well, not the administration, but how should I say, the powers that be, had it in for President Nixon. I mean, President Nixon, during his reign as president, basically gave the global New World Order and the agendas that were going on at the time, he basically gave them everything that they wanted. Why was it that these same establishment forces worked against him to bring his presidency to an end? And I think one of the key points about this is something that happened earlier in President Nixon's career. Our analysis here at World Affairs Brief believes that the reason that President Nixon's presidency was put through the ringer in this way was because of something he did during a trial where he was the prosecuting attorney. This trial occurred against an alleged communist agent named Alger Hiss, who was eventually convicted of perjury. Alger Hiss was named as a communist agent by a former fellow communist whose name was Whitaker Chambers. And Nixon, as a prosecuting attorney, eventually proved that Hiss's typewriter was the machine that produced several incriminating documents turned over to communist agents. Nixon was given the job of prosecuting Alger Hiss, and he saw this as his opportunity or his road to fame and glory. But during the course of the investigation, Nixon failed to see several warning signs that indicated that the entire Washington establishment was trying to save Hiss, Alger Hiss. Many people wonder why Washington, which was at that time considered quite anti-communist, would actually want to save Alger Hiss from prosecution. But if you look at the history of communist agents like Harry Dexter White and others, the establishment had always seemed to shield them. But never had the establishment seemed to fight with such tenacity as they did to save Alger Hiss. Alger Hiss was a very suave and sophisticated person, and the results of the investigation showed that he was a government or an agent inside the highest levels of our government. We at the World Affairs Brief believe that Alger Hiss wasn't really a communist agent. In fact, he was a different agent. It was more of a double agent. He was working for a higher agenda, a global agenda, part of the New World Order agenda, whose reason was to play both sides against each other to develop a stronger foothold for the New World Order. It's interesting to note that after Alger Hiss finished up his sentence, he went on to become the principal author of the United Nations Charter. As an agent, Alger Hiss, who obviously believed most of the communist ideals, infiltrated into our government for sort of a long range purpose, and that was to further the agenda of the New World Order. Nixon at the time didn't see this aspect of it, and for a long time he was sort of confused as to why the establishment was so dead set against him. He commented multiple times during the Nixon tapes, whenever he would come up with a difficult people's problem, he would refer back to the difficulties he had while he was prosecuting Alger Hiss. He would talk about, for instance, when he was talking, here's actually a quote, when he was talking about how to proceed against Daniel Ellsberg, who leaked the Pentagon Papers, which was an incriminating bit of evidence against his administration around that time. He said, quote, "We won the Hiss case in the papers. We did. I had to leak stuff all over the place to do it." This demonstrates as well sort of the atmosphere at the time, which was that the way that the government manipulated things was to use leaks that were useful to them, and this was a very accepted means among the political process to gain certain ends, was to leak political information to the newspapers.
Now, I think that quotation you take actually was from the transcript of the tapes that were being recorded in the Oval Office at the time. So
Nixon, when
he's coming up against this whole group of people who are opposing his war effort, Daniel Ellsberg, of course, had given the New York Times copies of the Pentagon Papers, which would reveal that the Gulf of Tonkin incident was phony, that there was no justification for the war. Almost 58,000 American boys are dead, a couple of million Vietnamese are dead, all for absolutely nothing, and Nixon's trying to figure out, you know, how he's going to deal with Daniel Ellsberg, how he's going to get this guy, because Nixon always wants gets people. He got he'd like to get Ellsberg as well.
Right, that's right, and Ellsberg turned around and gave up the Pentagon Papers, which were documenting most of the internal communication, I believe, that was going on about the conflict at Vietnam. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Well, no, this is absolutely right. I think the interesting point that you're making is that there is another force which people don't recognize. Anybody who's ever read the Ian Fleming books will remember, of course, that there was Ian Fleming wrote the James Bond series. And there was, of course, the capitalist, and then there were the communists. And then there was a third force. It was Spectre. It was the force that nobody recognized, but it was always there working behind the scenes, Spectre. Well, of course, Ian Fleming really understood what was going on. He'd been part of MI5, British Intelligence, during the Second World War. And this was the way he had of trying to tell the American people and the people of the world that there was another force out there that nobody recognized. Of course, he died as a very, very young man. As so often happens with people, try to begin to bring the truth out about what's going on. And of course, I think that this time, at the Hiss time, people don't understand that communism had been financed by the United States, by the United States banks, by United States corporations, and we were doing everything we could to keep the communists going, the best enemies money could buy. Hiss, as a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, he's a close personal friend of Dean Acheson, who was the Secretary of State at that time, of John Foster Dulles, who becomes the Secretary of State when Eisenhower becomes the President. Alger Hiss is actually taken by President Roosevelt as his personal advisor when he goes to Yalta and, of course, makes all the concessions to Stalin. And then Alger Hiss is the first acting Secretary General of the United Nations and draws up the United Nations Charter. And by the time this whole issue comes out about Alger Hiss, why Alger Hiss, being a communist, why Alger Hiss is the president of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, one of those powerful foundations in the entire country and certainly one of the most influential. So here's this man that Richard Nixon is going after, and he's going to prove he is a communist. And of course, the character witnesses for Alger Hiss are John Foster Dulles, the Secretary of State Dean Acheson, Felix Frankfurter, Supreme Court Justice. The whole Washington establishment, New York establishment, is defending Alger Hiss against this charge. He's a communist, and I don't think Richard Nixon ever really understood what was really going on.
I think you're right.
Go right ahead.
You're absolutely right. No, I think that that's the key point in the entire Watergate scandal. We think, actually, that the the whole reason that Watergate came about is that the establishment never really forgave Richard Nixon for going as hard as he did to prosecute Alger Hiss. He didn't back down. He didn't give in to the pressure that was going on around him by establishment sources. He talked about in the Nixon tapes, he would talk about the establishment not backing him up. There's a quote in there about Hoover himself. He says, in fact, I've got it right here, he says, quote, Hoover himself, who was a friend of mine, said, quote, I'm sorry, I've been ordered not to cooperate with you. This is actually on the Nixon tapes. This is Nixon himself talking. He says that Hoover told the president that he was ordered not, well, he wasn't the president at the time, that I can't help you.
This is as far as the conviction then of Alger Hiss. In other words, Hoover had been ordered not to go along with the conviction of Alger Hiss. Is that a fair statement?
Yes. No, that's exactly what was happening. And it wasn't just Hoover. It was all the major administrations that were supposed to be supporting him in this were actually trying to undermine his efforts to prosecute Alger Hiss.
Well, if you ever have a chance, for our listeners, you need to get the book Witness, written by Whitaker Chambers. And this is a fascinating insight into that, what happened at that time and what happened with Nixon. And Whitaker Chambers was always afraid he was going to be arrested rather than Alger Hiss, because he recognized the whole Washington establishment was behind Hiss, and here he was a guy just trying to tell the truth. Well, we were just commenting that one of the great books of modern times was written by Whitaker Chambers. It's called Witness, and I read this probably 43 years ago, and it had a profound impact upon my life at that time, and really pointed me back towards the Lord, and of course gave me a tremendous sense of history. I don't think Whitaker Chambers ever really understood what this was all about either, but it's an important part of history, and of course, as Andrew is bringing out, why it is their contention that one reason the establishment was going after Nixon and the Watergate era, it was payback time for what Nixon had done to Alger Hiss. So pick up the story there.
Well, I think one of the hardest things for many people to understand is once we bring up this point, they say, well, that just doesn't make sense. I mean, Richard Nixon worked for the establishment. I mean, if you look at his track record, Nixon practically gave the establishment everything that they wanted. If you look at his track record, he sold out American security by releasing the miniature ball bearing technology to the Soviets, which allowed their missiles to gain accuracy to within 100 meters, which was a major sellout. Together with Henry Kissinger, he gave basically the lives of millions of Vietnamese at the Paris Peace Talks. He gave away Taiwan to the Chinese Communists by recognizing Red China as its own country and replacing Taiwan with Red China as a Chinese representative in the UN Security Council in 1971. I mean, these are all things that are not indicative of a conservative, of a Republican president, which Nixon was supposed to be at the time. And all of these things about his track record showed that he was bending over backwards to give up any supposed ideals that he might have to the establishment cause, which was to undermine American security and pave the way for the New World Order in various aspects of world politics at that time. And yet the establishment had this grudge against him, we think, because of his prosecution of Alger Hiss. And if you look at the history of the Watergate scandal itself, the Watergate scandal that was about break-in into the Democratic National Committee's headquarters, and it was foiled at that time, and several people were arrested and connected with the Republican National Committee donation checks that were then found their way into bank accounts of these supposed burglars who had botched this burglary is basically the essence of the Watergate case against Nixon. But if you look at the details about that, certain things start to stand out and become suspicious about it. Let's see if I can put that together for our listeners a little bit. If you look at the evidence of the entire operation that was botched.
Hold that thought for just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Andrew Scows, and we're talking about the Watergate break-in, and Andrew is pointing out that certainly a Watergate break-in, there were a number of things that really didn't quite make sense about the details of why this was such a terrible thing. Basically, they'd broken into the Democratic headquarters. My goodness, they do this thing all the time. Certainly, the President Bush has taken this into a war. We're using faulty intelligence, telling us that Saddam Hussein was about to attack us at any minute. We had to immediately go to war. We've already lost about 1,700 Americans killed, probably 10,000, 15,000 permanently damaged, crippled for life. We've probably killed close to 100,000 Iraqis, or either they've unnecessarily, we've killed them all, or they have died because of the war. If we had not had the war, they would not be dead. And nobody's talking about impeaching George Bush because of that, because he lied to the American people to get us into the war. It was all contrived. The war was planned long, long before the September 11th attack. So why, what was really so terrible about Watergate? I'm not excusing it. Richard Nixon was an evil little man, but why did they make such a big fuss at that time? So you pick up the story there, Andrew.
No, that's a very good introduction. It's true that what happened was it was certainly illegal. How much of it was actually a mountain made out of a molehill is something that requires a little bit of closer analysis. I think that what many people didn't realize at the time, and many people don't realize now, is that government agencies are constantly spying on each other to a certain extent. There was at the time of Watergate, Hoover's administration, I'm sorry, Hoover, who was over the FBI at the time, had these black bag groups that would go around and do these illegal searches at the time of various different government agencies, and these have been documented, and in fact, several people have been prosecuted since then. This wasn't that uncommon of a thing. Nixon at this time got sloppy and a little possibly overconfident with how he handled his particular investigation with things, but if you take a closer look at the group that was arrested burglarizing the Democratic National Committee's headquarters during the Watergate scandal, they were supposedly put together by G. Gordon Liddy and E. Howard Hunt, who were the prime suspects. They were shown to have put the team together, and yet neither of these two people were present when the burglars were caught. And if you take a closer look at the team and the way they operated, you could see that none of these men were professionals, and none of them were specialists in either lock picking or planting bugs. They were doing a job of installing bugs in the DNC's headquarters, and consequently got caught because of it.
No, in fact, I almost had a feeling that they were intentionally got caught. I mean, here they
yes,
were.
Yes, it feels
three
that
of
way.
These
I
people
agree.
Were actually Cuban nationals, I remember. There were only one or two other people there. I mean, they're breaking into the headquarters of the Democratic Party. They, of course, are going in. They tape the doors so that they won't lock behind them. And, the guard comes around, finds that the tape is on the door, thinks it may have been put by accident, takes it off, closes the door, the group comes out, they find the tape's been removed, they put it back on again. It was almost like they were trying to get caught, almost as if this whole thing was a setup to get Richard Nixon from the very beginning, because I remember exactly the details of what happened at that time, and it never made sense. I mean,
We're
talking with people, actually some of them highly trained CIA officials. You don't make mistakes like that. You don't send people into Daniel Ellsberg's office, get a file out. And, of course, they borrow a camera from the CIA. They take pictures of one another, and then they forget, and they leave the film and the camera when they give it back to the CIA. And they go into the office to steal that, and they totally disrupt the office. Why not go in and just take out the file? Why, tear everything up and throw files all over? Drawing attention to themselves. Nothing about what happened at that time made any sense if they were really trying, of course, to get information on Daniel Ellsberg or put the bugs in the office there. But if you were trying to topple a president, well, maybe it all makes a lot more sense. Because either we've got the most incompetent intelligence agencies in the world or this was a scam from the very beginning. We're going to be back here in just a moment with Andrew Skousen from World Affairs Brief. Well, this is Dr. Stan here. Andrew, why don't you pick up the story from there?
All right. I think we've made some very good historical summary of what happened. I'd like to comment a little bit about the new developments now, about Felt himself. The Watergate story put in the limelight the use of reporters using insider access inside of government to develop huge stories. And this has, of course, been something that's been in the media recently about reporters using government leakers. And any investigative journalist who wants to make a living has to have a great number of insider connections to get information that the rest of the reporters don't have. And usually the reporters who have the most access have a very left-leaning analysis of current events and the news. The press in this case has talked about Felt in a grandiose light. They quote him as being a great American hero who went well above and beyond the call of duty to risk himself to save his country from horrible injustice. But if you take a closer analysis about who Felt was, you come up with a slightly different conclusion. Felt, at the time, was the number two man in the FBI. We believe that, as Deep Throat, he wasn't acting alone and that he wasn't acting for the country's best interest. It's important to note, and it's a side note, really, in today's world, is that leaking classified information to the press is illegal. And yet, it's done all the time to certain favored columnists and investigative reporters.
But usually the information that gets out is the information that they want to get out. In other words, somebody wants that information out specifically.
Agreed. And considering the government's ability to tap phones with the Patriot Act and the provisions that the government has at its disposal, it's almost impossible that any major government...
Hold that off right there.
Yeah.
Well, Dr. Stan, our guest this evening, Andrew Skousen, and he's talking about, of course, the time of when Mark Felts was leaking information to Woodward and Bernstein, and of course, this was illegal for him to have done that. What was his true motivation? Was this altruistic? He just felt we had a corrupt president, or was there another agenda behind it? And then, of course, Andrew is making the point right today that now, in the name of fighting terrorism, why, they have all sorts of taps on all sorts of people's telephones, and they're listening. Well, of course, we know the NSA is listening to all telephone conversations, going over them with computers that are actually looking for keywords, and then, of course, there's anything suspicious, why, it'll be listened to by a human being. So, but basically, it is impossible today to do almost anything without them watching you, knowing where your money is, knowing what your medical history is, knowing who you're calling, knowing what you're doing on the with your emails. They're tracking what websites you're going to. They're collecting dossiers on every citizen. And this would, of course, include government employees and reporters today. So they know who's leaking whatever information to others. But let's get back to Mark Felts, and you pick up the story there, Andrew.
Well, no, that's a very good introduction. Thank you. And that's such an illegal practice, and wiretapping is such a viable option for government that true government leakers know beforehand that they're going to be shut down before any major story can make it to press. In most cases, the internet fortunately is helping to take away that, but it's very dangerous for anybody inside the deeper side of government to come out with dangerous information. In fact, Felt himself, when he was talking to Woodward and Bernstein, but particularly to Woodward, expressed to him that he believed that he was constantly under surveillance, as was the Washington Post at the time. And Mr. Felt, if anybody, was in a position to know. As number two man in the FBI, he was very familiar with the aspects of getting information using the FBI's technique. In fact, in later years, Felt was actually was actually prosecuted for some of the information gathering practices that he was participating in.
In other words, they were actually searching people's home, tapping phones without warrants. Without they could have gotten a warrant. They just didn't obey the law, and of course, he was eventually prosecuted and sent to prison.
That's right. That's right.
And of course, he made a great point. I'm just being persecuted. It's those wicked communists that, they're out to get me. The communists are. And he even had a big, fund that all the FBI agents contributed to. They sort of, like a band of brothers, they put together. But Felts violated the law. I mean, he was just as criminal as the president was. But, of course, nobody ever mentions that.
It's true. And Felts seemed to act in a way that he thought that he was above the law with this, and the media was snapping up his information. The Post stories were the hottest things out during that time. Anything about Watergate was given front page news and was talked about by everyone. It's very interesting, in fact, to compare the amount of press that Watergate got at the time with the amount of press that something like something that the media is trying to play down, for instance, Whitewater or something similar to it, which involves a person that the media is actually trying to protect, such as Bill Clinton, and compare the two aspects. And if one of the things that had happened in the Whitewater investigation had happened during the Watergate investigation, it would have been huge, and yet it was absolutely not mentioned during the Whitewater presentation. It's a very interesting example of of how the media bias works.
Well, of course, the media supported Bill Clinton no matter what he did. The media hated Richard Nixon, or at least the people who really control the media. And what you must understand is that the establishment, which controls the media, had wanted Richard Nixon to stay in office. They would have killed these stories, just like they killed for years, and he mentioned the Bilderberg organizations, or this group that really rules the world. On the other hand, you know, if they wanted to blow the stories up, why, you'd see just what happened to Richard Nixon with Bill Clinton, why they killed most of the stories concerning him, forcible rape, remember when he was going to be impeached, and there was a story about Juanita Broderick, who he had raped, and I believe it was ABC, or I guess it was ABC that actually had that on film, and they would not show it until after the impeachment was over. Why? Because they didn't want anything to happen to Billy Boy. You see, the establishment was the force that made all the excuses for Bill. And, of course, set out to get Richard Nixon, and the question is, why?
That's right. And that actually brings up a very interesting point about the Whitewater case. In history, up until that time, the government had gradually been developing its sources of power with covering up things, by influencing judges and the judicial system and the police force and, of course, handling key people in the CIA and the FBI to the point where they could tackle something like even the toppling of a president. In that case, it was they could do something like the JFK assassination and get away with it because of the power within the government itself, and with the cover-up among the government conspirators.
And of course,
Watergate, yeah.
I was just going to say, there's no way they could have gotten away with the murder of President Nixon without the full support of both J. Edgar Hoover and the Central Intelligence Agency. It's either one of the groups had told the truth, it would have been very obvious that the conspiracy came from the United States, and that the CIA was involved, and certainly the Mafia was involved, and even the special forces were involved. That was well known, but the American people never were allowed to know that.
That's right. And so that instance illustrated the government's power amongst its own divisions. And the Watergate illustrated a new era of government cover-up, and that was the cover-up of the media itself, using the media itself to focus in on certain aspects that they wanted advanced and covering up for certain aspects that they didn't want advanced, and could show that they had enough power with the media alone, with manipulating leaks, with manipulating how evidence was presented or shut down or encouraged or discouraged, to actually topple a presidency using that power alone.
And that, they can topple anybody, they can make anybody that they want to into a hero, as they're doing with John McCain now. Have you ever noticed how we always hear about John McCain, why he's the real power in the Senate today? Whenever they want to ask a question, they go to John McCain. Why? Why? Because he's a traitor to the country. He went over to the Vietnamese. He betrayed all the other POWs. The POWs hate John McCain. But you're never going to hear that mentioned by ABC, CBS, or NBC. So they can build somebody up, John McCain, maybe the next Republican nominee for the presidency of the United States. Why? Because he's been picked by the people who control the media, and they focus their attention on him. And other important issues you never hear of, other important and significant and powerful senators are hardly ever mentioned.
That's right. No, that's a very cogent analysis, Dr. Spann. Exactly how people are chosen to be put into the limelight in sort of subtle ways like that, asking their opinion, treating them like experts. You see that happen with certain people who make it into politics, like Colin Powell and Condoleezza Rice. These people were also constantly panicked to by the media before their nominations to these positions as experts in various areas, and they're constantly put in the limelight with these sort of excuses. And it's very deceptive. Very few people have the ability to see past that and question, well, why did they choose to ask this person? And if people would ask that question, I think that they would invariably come away with a slightly suspicious question mark afterwards about the person, because very often the analysis isn't that cogent from the people that the press picks.
Okay, so where do we go from here?
Well, I'd like to comment a little bit about what John Dean had to say about Mr. Felt. John Dean recently published an article in finlaw.com, finlaw.com. John Dean, many people will remember, was Nixon's White House counsel who turned the state's evidence on the president. And he comments that he says, to say that, he says, the revelation of his identity, talking about Mark Felt, raises many new questions that it seems Felt himself will not be able to answer. He says, when I took a hard look at Felt years ago, I concluded he could not have known what Throat knew when the information was given to Woodward, particularly since he was gone from the FBI at the end, and I scratched him off the list of viable candidates. What had happened was what Felt had been moved out of the FBI at the end, and yet the Deep Throat source continued to give information to Woodward, in-depth information to Woodward and the Washington Post about the Watergate scandal. In our opinion, this actually illustrates that Felt was deeper inside the dark side of government and the FBI, such that he continued to be part of the loop after he was removed from his position in the FBI, such that he continued to have access to this important information and was able to continue to leak important parts of the investigation to these reporters.
That's a very interesting point. In other words, somebody was helping him get the information out. He was not acting alone, is what you're saying.
That's right, exactly. And if you look at Felt was not necessarily one of the kind of person you would see as masterminding this kind of an attack on the president. In our opinion, Felt was sort of a parrot person, someone there who was manageable and followed orders and was a good reliable way to send information out. He was trusted in the FBI by Hoover, the person who was put in charge over him after Hoover was a Mr. Gray who was kind of kept out of the light by Felt. There's a couple of quotes about Gray saying, well, I've got to go and check back with Felt about this. Gray was obviously kept in the dark by Felt, and Felt had very key positions inside of the FBI, especially with regard to illegal searches. Later, I mentioned this before, but Felt was indicted and convicted actually by President Carter's Justice Department for continuing the practice of illegal searches. He was later pardoned by President Ronald Reagan for the practice of these searches. And this points to the fact that Felt, while he was in the FBI, had deeper connections to the secret side of the FBI, the side that did the illegal operations, the illegal searches, the black bag routines. And it's also a very interesting point that the one thing that Felt was convincing the rest of of the country that was so bad about President Nixon. He was actually involved in himself these illegal searches and operations that the FBI was going on. So it was deeply involved with these. I think there's a little bit of double dealing there for sure.
Okay, fine. Well, of course, then where did we end up as far as Mark Pelt is concerned? Who was he working for? How did he continue getting information after he had left the FBI? Do we have any ideas? Or do you think he was simply being manipulated by the establishment that was still intent upon using him to get Richard Nixon?
Well, I don't think that Felt was ever really outside of the loop, even after he moved out of the number two position of the FBI. I think that he continued to be a part of the darker side of government and consequently was privy to most of that.
And of course, you know, there are a number of forces working within government. One of them, of course, is the Council on Foreign Relations. Another is the Masons. Certainly J. Edgar Hoover was a 33rd degree Mason. He always put Masons into key positions, and you have to understand that the Council on Foreign Relations has its origin in the occult. Masonry has its origins in the occult. Certainly, when Hillary Clinton got to the White House, she was bringing in mediums to conjure up the spirits of Eleanor Roosevelt and Mahatma Gandhi. Certainly, Nancy Reagan was going to her astrology. So behind all of these things going on, you begin to see these occult forces that are working and manipulating behind the scenes, which are not obvious to the average individual, but are the real driving force behind everything going on in the world today. So pick up the story there, Andrew.
Yeah, I think that you're absolutely right, Dr. Stan.
Go ahead.
Okay, well, about Felt working alone, I think that the evidence in general makes it seem very unlikely that he was working alone. In fact, Woodward himself reported that when Woodward wanted to talk with Felt, or when Felt wanted to talk with Woodward, he would place a flower pot out on his window shelf, and Woodward himself was forced to comment that he was surprised that Felt could stop by so that Felt could check on this flower pot that Woodward would put out so often.
We'll be back in just a moment here.
All right.
Wrap up the program. Well, this is Dr. Stan. You've got 3 minutes to wrap things up.
Okay. Well, just to finish up this last point, I think one of the points that showed that Felt wasn't just a government leaker acting all by himself, but that this was actually an operation run by at least more than one person, was the fact that whenever Woodward, the Washington Post reporter, would want to gain some more information from this government leak that he had, Felt, he would place a flower pot with a certain road construction flag in it out on his windowsill. And Woodward was actually forced to comment himself on this because of the evidence that this was, that he was surprised that Felt was so quick to pick up on his signal. And it indicates that Felt actually had at least one more person working for him that was stationed there to watch for this signal and inform Felt about it.
In other words, what you're suggesting is that this was some sort of a secret network working behind the scenes of which Felt was simply a member, maybe one of the lead members, but certainly other people were involved along with him and continued feeding him information even out after he was supposedly out of the loop.
Exactly. So, in conclusion, I think that Watergate was the first demonstration of the power that the media, when controlled and guided by forces behind the scenes, could have over elements of the government. As such, the Watergate case not only put the Washington Post on the map, but it also laid the foundation for the globalist media partnership that has grown and strengthened over the years. Ever since Watergate, each president has known, beyond a doubt, that they are indebted to the powers that be for their position, and that the powers that be can take that position from them at any time. If you examine how insignificant the Watergate scandal was, they could take down a president for very small things, and the fact that that they didn't take someone down like President Clinton for the huge things that he did indicates the various favoritism that are depending on which president has power.
I agree with you totally, and I think that's a very, very interesting analysis of what went on there, and I think it's so vitally important that people begin remembering that they've got to challenge everything they read. Nothing is as it appears to be. What is the story behind the story? When you read the things in the newspaper, realize that they're put there to create your reality. You're going to have to be able to create your own reality and look beyond the obvious. We'll be back in just a moment to wrap up the program. Dr. Stan Andrew, would you tell our listeners how they can get a hold of the World Affairs Brief and maybe even get a free copy, and hopefully we'll want to subscribe to World Affairs Brief?
Certainly. In fact, I wish we had more time. This week's brief has so many more stories. We talk about the French and Dutch and how they rejected the EU Constitution, and we go into an in-depth analysis about the various countries, including the euro and its relationship to the dollar, as well as the recent things in Israel and the Chinese yuan. A great many things to comment on, and all of these can be found in the World Affairs Brief weekly news analysis that is put out by our group, and they can find a way to subscribe to that by logging on to www.worldaffairsbrief.com. That's one word, worldaffairsbrief.com. And they can find their stories that our researchers think are pertinent to understanding the true side of what's going on. And there's a short summary there with links. And then there's a link that you can click on to subscribe to the weekly analysis, which is more in-depth and we believe a better summary about the most important points of what's going on, as well as tracking what the globalist forces are doing to take away our liberty and slowly degrade the Constitution and our liberty.
Let's get your telephone number up, would you please?
Yes, they can also call toll-free 1-877-866-1888.
One more time.
That's toll-free, 1-877-866-6888.
Andrew, thank you so much for being with us this evening. It's always a pleasure. Look forward to having you on next week.
Great. Thank you, Dr. Stan.
Okay, fine. That was Andrew Skousen. We're going over, of course, the incredible story of Watergate and Mark Felton. Remember, there are other forces here. And if you look at this as simply the struggle between capitalism and communism, or now capitalism and terrorism, you're missing what this is all about. There are spiritual forces working behind the scenes which are, well, have seized the control of the souls of men. If you doubt that, you need to get the videos we offer. They sold their souls for rock and roll, although that deals with the music industry. It carries over into every aspect of life. You can get the 3-hour, the 4-hour, or the 10-hour versions. All are available on video, and the 3 and the 10-hour available on DVD. They sold their souls for rock and roll. You need to understand that there are people who've made contact with the other dimension. They've made contact with organized evil, and they've gone over to the other side, to the dark side. So this has happened down throughout the ages, but I believe we're coming to a climax in history. If you haven't read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, you need to get it. That's Brotherhood of Darkness. We recommend Megiddo 1, Megiddo 2, put out by Chris Pinto. That gives you a good overview of the spiritual nature of the battle we're engaged in, all available by calling 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Please go to our website at radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com. And of course, you can listen to our programs there 5 hours a day. Let me remind you that we do sell the Big Berkey products, and we have, of course, the Sanjian radios, and we have the Miracle 2 products. All of these things do help us, but we are still primarily listener-supported, and we do hope that many of you will give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters, or simply subscribe to our newsletter. All these things help as we reach out 5 hours a day by radio and by internet and by satellite, and 4 hours a day by shortwave, bringing people the news behind the news, the story behind the story. So pray for America, pray for revival, but understand this is a spiritual battle, and please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And so until tomorrow, when we'll be back with you one more time, this week, Dr. Stan Goodnight, and may the Lord be with you.